When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, is Brian Reese.
Hey, Paul, how's it going?
It's going pretty good.
Fantastic.
Yes. So on the today on the program, we'll be discussing the seminal run of Daredevil, Born Again, written by Frank Miller with art by David Mazzucchelli. But before we get into that, I want to first give a huge thank you to Professor Allen for putting us on a short list of favorite new podcast of 2017. This was really great. A very humbling thing to have happen.
But it is a great honor, and we really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's really, really nice. Yeah, you know, we sit here and just have these conversations. It's nice to know that there's actually people listening to us. That's cool. So thank you. A couple of things have happened since last we spoke, Brian, and probably the most important and, you know, the most world-shaking thing.
Earth-shattering, yes.
Earth-shattering. And that is the fact that Superman is getting his red underwear back.
Woo!
Woohoo! The return of the undies. Yes.
And there was much rejoicing.
So in all seriousness,
Andrew's company is all on Twitter about it.
Yes. On Twitter.
On Twitter.
So in all seriousness, what do you think about this? Do you think it's a good thing?
Oh, sure. I think it's a lovely thing. I personally didn't care that he was without when they took the red trunks. And they are trunks, Paul. Trunks. Not underwear.
Uh-huh.
Underwear is worn under. No, but I thought, you know, it didn't really bother me that they went away. But, you know, them coming back, it's kind of iconic. And, you know, you get the spoil sports out there. Well, you know, Paul, you wouldn't actually wear your trunks on the outside, you know, all that junk. You know, we're talking about comics. You know, it doesn't really matter if a suit is actually functional or not. This isn't real life.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a classic look. I mean, it's the iconic look that Superman has had for all those years. And, you know, the whole idea of it back in the day was the fact that, you know, that's what wrestlers wore.
Right.
So, and he was a strong man, and that's kind of the thing that they were going for. Yeah. And it's fine. I was kind of with you. I don't really mind that they're not there, but you know, them coming back, it's kind of good. I don't think it works in live action.
No, but you know, you do things in comics that you can't possibly do in live action. So, absolutely, you know, yeah. why apply different standards to comics versus to one thing in a comic versus another thing in a comic? It's you know, let him have his red trunks. Let the red trunk lovers be happy. I'm happy. I'm glad it's back. Seems perfectly fine to me. If they didn't come back, I think I would manage to live my life as well. But no,
it's just nice that he's wearing pants at all. I mean, he could be Dr. Manhattaning it.
Right, which and the red trunks do add an extra level of package protection.
Yes,
you know, because this is a PG rated Superman is a PG rated hero, so you don't want a whole lot of bulging.
Yeah. I mean, that is a Kryptonian package too. I mean, we got to assume
it came a long way.
Yeah, we got to assume it's super. If you know what I
yes.
mean.
Yes, you'd have to ask Lois Lane about that.
Okay. The bigger thing that goes around this, or the bigger, let's rephrase that. The bigger news that goes along with this is the fact that the trunks will be coming back in Action Comics 1000. And have you heard the lineup on this one, Brian?
I've seen, I've seen some of them. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a who's who.
Yeah. Well, I mean, first of all, it's the first work of Bendis in DC, which is not surprising.
Right. It's been well known he was probably going to take over Superman anyway, so.
Yeah, I mean, but in addition to that, you have Richard Donner, Jeff Johns, Pete Tomasi, Pat Gleason, Dan Juergens, Brad Meltzer, Louise Simonson, Jeff Ordway, Tom King, Scott Snyder, and Marv Wolfman scripting a story based on unpublished art by Kurt Swan.
Hmm.
That's pretty damned amazing right there.
But no John Byrne?
No John Byrne. I think the only way that they could make this complete is if, they had the mummified remains of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster propped up on display somewhere.
Yeah, but then they'd have to pay them, and God knows I don't want to do that.
Ooh.
Ooh.
There's your burn right there.
Oh, hey.
But wow, I'm really looking forward to that. That's going to be a pretty damned amazing issue.
Maybe. I mean, it sounds kind of anthology-esque, which sometimes works, sometimes doesn't.
Well, I'm sure. Yeah, I know for a fact that it's going to be an anthology.
Yeah.
But I don't care. Look at just to see the creators doing all new stuff. It's going to be wow. That's all I can say is wow. It's going to be super, Brian.
It'll be superb. As long as it has Crypto in it.
The Wonder Dog?
Crypto the Wonder Dog.
So I'm looking forward to that. Now, over on the Marvel side of things, first of all, Marvel has announced that Black Widow is finally going to get her own solo film. I, for one, say, about time. What have you guys been waiting for?
Well, good for them.
Oh, look at that enthusiasm. I mean, come on.
Well, yeah, it's fine. It could be great. It could be terrible. It could be nothing special. It's kind of early to tell. I mean,
Scarlett Johansson has proved herself to be a fine action star in her own right. Not only, in the MCU, but also in other films as well. And, it's Black Widow doing spy stuff. It's going to be great. Oh, by the way, spoiler for Infinity War, Black Widow lives. Anyway, I'm excited for that. I thought she should have had her own solo film ages ago.
Well, whatever happened to that Captain Marvel film? Remember, that was supposed to be...
It's filming right now.
Okay, because that was going to be the very first, census-shattering, female-led superhero movie ever of all time. Nothing will ever be the same Marvel thing. And then, a little film called Wonder Woman kind of snuck in ahead of that.
No, it's filming right now. You haven't heard the huge controversy? Because Brie Larson was seen in her uniform. And Brian, it's turquoise and white.
Heavens to Betsy, Paul.
I know. Fanboys are losing their minds on Twitter.
Are they getting the vapors?
Yes. So, I looked at that and said, oh, that's the colors that the original Captain Marvel originally wore. And then she's probably going to change into her iconic outfit later in the movie. Settle down. But I think my guess is that she's going to show up in Infinity War. It's not been announced or anything like that, but I think she'll just cameo in that, like the same way Black Panther did in Civil War. Okay. Well, again, all right. There you go. So anyway, I'm personally excited to see the Black Widow film. That's just something I've wanted to see for a while, and it's going to happen. The next big Marvel news is Gail Simone will be returning to Marvel after 12 years with a new ongoing series of Domino. So what do you think about that?
Well, it's always good to see Gail getting work.
No, I think she'll...
I'm a fan of Gail Simone's. Yeah, she's... My God, her run on DC is... it's 12 years. It might even be long. It feels longer. If it isn't longer, it feels longer. It feels like she's been DC with some excursions into Dynamite and others,
Well, yeah.
Smaller publishers, which... for quite some time. And she's been one of the most vocal DC defenders throughout, some of the during the great DC Marvel wars and whatnot. So, it's sad, for some people. Some people don't like Gail Simone. I think I enjoy her writing quite a bit. I enjoy her. I enjoy her Twitter presence very much.
As do I, yes.
Others do not. But sure, I think it's interesting that she's headed back to do some Marvel work. I don't know if she's ever been exclusive to either company, even though she worked almost exclusively for DC for so long. I don't know. I can't remember contractually whether she was completely tied to DC at some point. But no, it's good for her. It's an interesting choice for her to go back to. I don't think Domino is a top tier, mutant X character or what have you, but
no, I don't think that's the problem. But it is a strong female character that she's right. In charge of, and I think it's something that she can grab a hold of and make it her own you know, as opposed to...
And I think Simone, you know, I mean, she's done great work with, I mean, you know, the Secret Six, both iterations that she wrote of it were really a lot of fun. So she can take, you know, the non sort of what you'd call the non top tier characters and really have some fun with them. It'd be interesting if they, if they allow her to write what she wants without a lot of editorial finagling going on in the background. I think it could be a lot of fun.
Yeah, and I think that that's kind of where it's headed to. To me, this is an indication of Marvel has cleaned house and they're sort of setting the ship right again. And this, I just think this is an indication of maybe good things will be coming from Marvel, or better things, I should say.
Maybe they keep promising us this like massive return of all these like famed writers and artists, and we haven't really seen it. I mean, all of their new, you know, rejigging of everything is just they're moving their in-house writers around to different titles, which
that's a good thing, I think, you know,
which doesn't, but it doesn't feel particularly all new, all special, all earth-shattering.
I think it's they're still getting their house in order, and you know, the return of Gail Simone is a big deal. The only downside I see to this is that one of the artists working on this will be Greg Land.
Oh dear.
Yeah, and I'm not.
Oh dear. I you know what? Why would Gail Simone ever let? Why would she agree to Greg Land as an artist?
That she's. I don't know. I don't have all the information from me. I think he might just be doing covers, but maybe Simone will temper his, let's say, unsavory impulses.
Unless she's standing behind him and checking where he's getting his photo references from.
Yeah. Pornhub, anybody?
Oh, jeez.
All right.
The man doesn't even try.
No, he really doesn't. But anyway, I think that's a good thing. I'm looking forward to, you know, Domino's never been one of my favorite characters or anything, but I think she'll do really good things with it.
Well, and it's a character, you know, it's sometimes I will follow a character because I like the writer.
Exactly.
I often follow writers. I'm mixed. Sometimes I follow writers. Sometimes I follow characters. Sometimes a little bit of both. Gail Simone is someone who I have an interest in what she's writing. I don't like everything she writes, but some stuff I like a whole lot. So
yeah, it's definitely something I would like to check out. Well, I think that's it for the news right now. Why don't we take a break, and when we come back, let's talk a little Born Again.
Hallelujah.
Okay, doing the new promo. Do not say take the dare. Do not say take the dare. Okay, go. Hello, darling. Nice to see ya. It's me, J. David Weider, the Conway Twitty of podcasting. But please call me Dave. I host a show called Dave's Daredevil Podcast, where I talk about Marvel's Man Without Fear and Netflix superstar Daredevil. But I'm here to tell you that things have changed. Don't worry, I've still got more hornhead goodness than you can shake a billy club at and a desperado love for Daredevil. And episodes of the show still come out each and every Sunday. But now, Dave's Daredevil Podcast is part of the Two True Freaks Podcast Network. That's right, the show can now be found at twotruefreaks.com, home of Earth's mightiest podcasts. And if you haven't tried the show before, I see the want to in your eyes. So take the time to check out Dave's Daredevil Podcast, because sometimes you need a podcaster with a slow hand. Dave's Daredevil Podcast, every Sunday at twotruefreaks.com. Take the dare. I have no self-control.
And we're back. Now, today on the program, we'll be discussing Daredevil Born Again. Now, Brian, this is your baby, so take it away.
Okay. Born Again is an arc of Daredevil written by Frank Miller and illustrated by Dave Mazzucchelli, with great coloring by Christy Scheel. It encompasses, in its collected editions, issues 227 to 233 of Daredevil, and marks the return of Miller to the character he first made his name with. The story is one of loss and redemption, with Matt Murdock seeing his entire life destroyed by the Kingpin, only to discover the small miracles of life he had forgotten. Looking for only a single fix, heroin addict Karen Page, Murdock's former lover, sells out Daredevil's secret identity, which ends up in the hands of the Kingpin, who begins a slow and steady process of destroying Matt Murdock's life, discrediting him as a lawyer, ruining his finances, and blowing up his home. Descending into paranoia and madness, Murdock finds himself lost and in despair, his body and mind being beaten and battered. When all seems lost, it is an act of grace and mercy from an unlikely source that sends Matt back on the journey of redemption, finding himself again in the eyes of others thought lost as well. Along with Murdoch, some of his most indelible supporting characters experience life changes of their own while mirroring and aiding Matt's journey. Foggy Nelson, Karen Page, Ben Urich, the Kingpin himself, Captain America, and even the erstwhile Turk all play roles in the salvation and rebirth of Matt Murdoch, Daredevil, the Man Without Fear. The story is heavy in religious themes, which plays well into Murdoch's Catholicism and serves, as always, in contrast to the devilish avatar he chooses to show the world. As Kingpin opines, I have shown him that a man without hope is a man without fear. So, Paul, what did you think?
You know what, Brian? I'm going to defer that right now, and I'm going to say, you tell me. You start, because I have some thoughts, but I think we should start with you. With why did you choose this particular arc?
Well, I think at first of all, we've been dancing around doing a Daredevil collection for a while now. I think, you know, clearly I have referenced him numerous times in our previous podcasts, and regular listeners will probably know that he is a favorite character of mine. So I sort of figured it was time for us to do a Daredevil, and I think that this, of all the great Daredevil stories, may be the most iconic. It may be the most important. This is all arguably. Other people are going to have their favorite stories and have good reasons for it. But in my mind, this is the one where we see Murdoch, in particular, more than Daredevil, as something beyond just a comic book character. I think this is a very adult story arc. This is not written with kids in mind, which is strange because this was mid-80s. This is when a lot of the fan, you know, a lot of the base that they were playing to was still kind of skewing younger than older.
Yeah, but this was the beginning of the grim dark era.
Right.
Just when it was starting to become a thing.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that Mazzucchelli's art is phenomenal in this. I think it is.
Well, no, I agree with you. I think Mazzucchelli's art is stunning. It's really quite brilliant. And there are some various splash pages that are just gorgeous.
You know? Right. And some of those are splash pages that have been imbued in, like, sort of the comic book consciousness.
Yeah, the one in the splash page for is it Armageddon, where it's Daredevil kind of coming out of the flames.
Right.
It's a very iconic picture.
Yeah. So I also thought thematically and also structurally, I think structurally it is unique among many of the comic books being made at that time. It, in terms of the way it played with different tenses, with different points of view, that was done in a way that a lot of comics hadn't really found yet. A lot of writers hadn't found that voice yet, that way to present that.
Well, you know, conceptually, I don't disagree with anything you just said. Probably surprising to many, I am not a big fan of this story, of this arc. Let me clarify. I'm not saying this is a bad story. It's not. Artistically, both in the writing and the artwork, it's well done. It's a classic, and I know this. Its influence is felt right up until today, because the third season of Daredevil is going to be partially covering this arc. So
yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, so I know it's not bad. I personally don't like it. There's something that rubs me the wrong way about it. It kind of leaves a bad taste in my mouth when I read it.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I think the majority, I've been trying, you know, I reread it this week, you know, and it gave me that same feeling I had when I initially read it. And I think it's just, I can't stand Frank Miller. His writing, even though this is peak Frank Miller, and I understand that, you know, this is when he was at his creative, you know, zenith.
You are not alone.
But his writing is, and this is the word that keeps coming back to me, his writing is cruel. And it's not that, and don't get me wrong, it's not that I shy away from violence or sexuality. You know, far from it. I love good violence in my comic books. It's just that the way Miller writes these subjects, it's a sense of, I don't know, it's vicious. It's gratuitous. It's cruel.
Do you think he dislikes the characters he's writing?
He despises his characters. And here's the thing. And believe me, I get all the symbolism. I grew up Catholic. I get the whole Stations of the Cross thing. He will destroy his, he doesn't care about the character. All he cares about is his symbol, about his metaphor. Like, take for instance, Karen Page. First of all, he makes her a porn actress who sells out Murdoch for a hit of heroin. Now, I get that. It's Mary Magdalene, and she's the equivalent, and she's sort of like Judas selling Christ for 30 pieces of silver.
Right.
But he destroys the character of Karen Page just to get that metaphor across. He doesn't try to work the character of Karen Page into that story. He just crushes the character to shoehorn in his idea. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, you're kind of, I think you're partially, you've got a little bit of, some of your concerns is the women in Fridge issue, you know, almost.
Well, yes, but not only that, he does it with Ben Ulrich as well.
Right.
You know, I mean, I get that Ulrich is yeah, again, the Catholic thing, he's Peter denying Christ.
Right.
But this is a detriment to the nobility of Ben Ulrich, the character. Miller doesn't care about him. He doesn't care about the history of that character. All he cares about is, you know, the symbol he wants to force feed down your throat. And, all he cares about is his metaphor and the history and the characters of the comic be damned. And that really kind of bothers me, obviously.
Clearly.
Yeah. Now, okay. All that being said, I do understand artistically that this is a classic story. And I can discuss this from a detached sense because I can see its merits. There are merits to this. I'm not blind to that. Huh, Daredevil.
Hey!
I have a sense about it. I do want to go on and discuss how the story is told because I do understand. It has, what you said earlier, it has a great structure. And I've been rambling on for quite a bit. Do you want to rebut anything I just said?
Well, I think I don't disagree necessarily in your take on whether Miller is a difficult writer. He always has been.
Yeah.
He wasn't as notoriously difficult during this time as he has become now in later years. But I would wonder, like, if you are correct and Miller just, you know, despises the characters that he's writing and he is just using them as a crutch to a bigger story that he wants to tell or a larger message that he's trying to get across, I wonder if that's necessarily a bad thing. Because, you know, it's, how do I say this? I would not want to get overly precious with, like, historical context of the characters when the writer is using those characters, he's using them in the way he wants, not the way that necessarily all the fans want.
Well, no, there's a difference. I don't think that it's not necessarily that he hates those characters, is that he doesn't care about them. It, you know, the way the characters have been presented and the way that they've grown, he doesn't give a damn about that. He just wants to tell his story. Now, other writers have done this as well. I mean, look at Brubaker's Captain America run.
Right.
You know, what he did with Bucky is, you know, beyond, you know, the kid's sidekick. He took something and threw it out the window and created something entirely new. But he still had respect for that old, for what has come before. He still had respect for what came before, and he worked within those limits to create something new. Frank Miller, on the other hand, just doesn't give a shit about what came before. And He doesn't care. Yeah, that's what keeps me coming back to. He doesn't care about those characters.
I'm not sure I agree. I'm not sure. Again, remember, this is the comic book that he lobbied for, that he was doing the art for and disliked the writing on and lobbied and won the right to write and draw it back in his first run on this. So these are characters, and this is a comic, and this is, you know, these are ideas that he clearly has put time, effort, and certainly a lot of attention to in his life leading up to this point.
But if you look at that first, if you look at that first run and compare it to this, there's a completely different attitude towards how he wants to address this story, how he wants to address these characters.
Sure. Well, he changed.
Yeah.
And maybe he changed in the way you're saying, but I think, yes, he, all of these characters get kind of drugged through the mud.
Yeah.
The whole point of this being that, you know, they're all getting beaten down in some way. And the question is then, where does redemption come from? And, you know, if really bad things didn't happen to Ben Urich or Karen Page, then does any sort of redemptive thing that happens with them, what does that mean then? It's like, oh, you know, my puppy died. I'm really sad, but I will rise above, and it'll be a heroic, arc that I rise above the death of my puppy.
And that's trivializing that. I'm not talking about, not having bad things happen to your characters. I mean, of course, you know, the first rule of writing is kill your darlings. So you have to pile on bad things in their lives. But the way Frank Miller does it is degrading. Yeah, I find it very difficult to read the way he treats his characters. It's not an enjoyable read to me. And again, I do want to emphasize, this is my opinion, and it's
sure,
you know, and there is going to be many, many, many people who disagree with what I'm saying.
Right.
But when I read this arc,
why didn't he just let Karen Page insert the needle there in the end? Because that would have been, you know, if I didn't care about the character that much, if I really wanted to lay it on, you know,
this is the Christ metaphor that he's running through.
Yeah. Right, yeah. I understand.
And he has to redeem Mary Magdalene at the end. So, you know, and again, it doesn't matter that it's Karen Page. He could have just made up somebody new. He doesn't give a shit about Karen Page. All he cares about is the metaphor that runs through his story.
Well, I think it had to be Karen Page or someone similar, someone who would have to evince that level of emotion in Matt Murdock. It also had to be someone who knew, who had history with him.
Yeah, well, you know, and again, that's the Judas equivalent. It had to be your best friend that sells you out.
Right.
I'm not arguing, I mean, from a pure writing standpoint, Miller does this exceptionally well. It's plotted brilliantly. It's paced really well. His use of those sharp, pointed, short sentences that he does, it's well done, and it works for this story. I'm not, you know, on a technical level, it's done incredibly well, and I realize that from an artistic standpoint, it's done really well. You know, his writing will become stiff and jarring in the future, but for he knows what he's doing. And I get that. I guess I'm of two minds. I see its artistic merit, and at the same time, I don't like it. And that's just a personal thing on my end.
So, just just out of curiosity, we can move on to, if you did not have any knowledge of Daredevil, if you didn't know these characters and did not have a relationship with these characters, would you feel the same? Do you think that you would feel the same way?
I have no way to answer that because I do have a background with Daredevil, and that I do have that history, and it's really hard to divorce myself from that idea. So maybe, but I can't really say for sure.
Okay. It's just that it's interesting because I have, you know, a long-standing relationship with a lot of these characters. They're fictional. When I say relationship, I obviously mean,
oh yeah,
in a fictional realm. I did not feel the same way as you do about how he's treating them.
Well, you know, opinions are subjective.
Yeah.
People like things for different reasons. It's amazing.
Okay. It's okay to let people like things.
I know. It's almost like, we're nuanced human beings with varied opinions.
That's crazy talk.
I know. Let's talk about the iconic things that happen in this storyline, because it is an incredibly influential story.
Sure. Well, one of the things that I have loved about this arc, and sort of some of Marvel and particularly Daredevil during the 80s, well, it's the art. The art is, which we've referenced several times, Mazzucchelli's art, which is quite inspiring. But I also feel like I need to give a shout out to Christy Scheel,
mm-hmm.
the colorist.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think that her coloring, and she goes by Christy at one point and then Max at another point. She has changed her name numerous times in her comic book career. She no longer works in comics, I don't believe. But I think she complements Mazzucchelli's line work so well with the colors that she chooses, particularly the winter scenes, where, with her use of that blue. Mm-hmm. If one hasn't read this, it's a visual trick that she does with the coloring that I think is quite profound.
Yeah, there's sort of a smoky noir feel to it.
Right. But it creates a New York. When I was a kid, I looked and I thought about New York City. I looked to Marvel Comics. And my perception of what New York City was like, what it looked like, how people acted in New York, was straight out of Marvel Comics. And like Daredevil in particular, because it's Hell's Kitchen, because it's even more, I think, than Spider-Man, for me, mm-hmm. was, you know, looking at Frank Miller's drawings of New York and Dave Mazzucchelli's drawings of New York. And it really carries this. I've been in New York numerous times since then, for real. And of course, yes. It's not like what it is in the comic book, but I still have in the back of my mind, when I read this comic book, I think that's New York City.
Yeah. Yeah, they do really make New York out to be just a terrible, terrible place.
Yes, they really do.
I mean, I've been to New York in the 80s, and people didn't just run you down and say, it's not worth the hassle, and
drive off.
But I do understand that they're hyper-accentuating the violence and the disinterest.
But I kind of wanted to live there. Based on some of that, you know, because you had the Hell's Kitchen part, but you also had the Manhattan parts, and you had the architecture, which the artists have done a really great job of presenting the architecture, of course, because they're just looking out their window.
Right.
It's a little easier to draw.
But it is very, you know, striking, you know, the Kirby view of New York, which is sort of these big iconic scenes, everything looking bright and futuristic to this depiction of New York, which is dark and smoky and
it's dirty. And it's scary, you know, and it's scary while not even being in, you know, pre-Disney Times Square.
Exactly.
There really is a Turk lurking around in every alley. And, you know, there really is a kingpin sitting up there, like in one of the skyscrapers, looking down upon all of the little people, you know, planning to squash them.
Yeah, well, I'd love the fact that at one point they're in Rockefeller Center at Christmas, and,
right?
And someone's purse gets stolen, and everyone just stands there and goes, "Eh," like that's not what happens.
but luckily, Foggy had a bowling ball.
Yes,
because he just happened to be carrying a bowling ball with him, like while they were doing Christmas shopping in Rockefeller Center.
And by the way, he smashes a guy in the head with a bowling ball, who stands up and then runs away. That was either one hell of a light bowling ball or just a hard head. But I do, you know, the Catholicism and Christ metaphors throughout the entire series is very. I think that's a really interesting framing device that they use, because each issue starts with a splash page that represents a station of the cross, which is, you know, I'll give you props for that. That was creative. Especially in 1985.
Yeah, and even the titling alone, you know, the titles of the chapters.
Right.
Are, what is it, Pariah, Born Again, Saved, Purgatory. You know, these are all like sort of Judeo-Christian concepts. Which I thought, when recommending this, knowing that you're a guy who studies religions rather extensively, it's like, well, that's up Paul's alley.
Again, I guess I just need to keep clarifying this. I do
understand.
I do understand and appreciate what they're trying to achieve here, and by and large, they do succeed in what they're trying to do. I think I just can't stand Frank Miller. That's what it comes down to. Oh boy,
well,
I can't wait
to hear what he says about you. But I think a lot of people. I guess we're going off topic slightly again, but I think a lot of people agree with you on Frank Miller, and I do not disagree with you on Frank Miller. Okay. I find a lot of his later writing to be unreadable. You know, it just, he has turned, he was slow. He, even here, you could see like some of, he's a misanthrope. He's an utter misanthrope, as you know, and yes, that does carry through in some of his writing, but I don't think, I wouldn't worry about apologizing because I don't think you're going to get a lot of people disagreeing with you on him being kind of a shitty person with his characters that he writes, even Batman and whatnot.
Oh, that's the one thing that I find incredibly unreadable from him is the end of Batman and Robin.
Yeah. Well,
because he never wrote it.
Batman and Robin was a mess.
I'm the goddamn Batman.
But it did give us that. if it gave us nothing else, it gave us I'm the goddamn Batman.
Indeed. So
child abuse.
So what did you think of the grand finale of this arc?
Which one?
The
nuke part?
The hyper-military attack on New York.
Well, I mean, it was batshit crazy.
Yeah. He's not subtle.
No, he's not subtle. I found, I think a couple of things that I found intriguing about it was the scene where Kingpin, who actually is probably the star of this entire arc,
where you get to see him in his underwear quite a bit.
There is a lot of Kingpin in his underwear. They're not red tights or red trunks. Actually, there may be a scene where he is wearing red. I don't remember. but it's the scene where he's talking to Nuke, trying to convince Nuke to do his bidding and, you know, attack Daredevil on U.S. soil, because Nuke has not operated in U.S. soil. And boy, howdy, some of his rhetoric sounds awfully familiar.
A little prescient?
A little prescient, yeah. I feel like a certain national leader must have been reading Daredevil at this time.
I would believe that if he actually read, but...
If he could read.
Yeah.
But there's even that bit where he talks about the press being the enemy, and Nuke is like, the press... I'm sitting there going, oh my God, this is today.
Yes. If he had said fake news, it would have been bad.
The only reason you don't say fake news is because fake news hadn't been invented as a term yet.
Exactly. Yeah, but you know what? As you know, as batshit crazy as that is, and his unsubtle attack on the paramilitary ideas of America.
Right.
But, you know, for all my ranting about him not getting or not caring about characters, he actually sort of gets Captain America right.
Yes, he does. I think Captain America in this, there's your redeeming character. If you want a character that he likes,
Yeah, which I find really interesting. And he does that contrast between Nuke being the, you know, hyper-jingoistic, over-the-top military guy.
Right.
And, you know, that crazy patriotism. And then you have Captain America who represents a dream, an ideal. Not just my country, no matter what.
And is clearly feeling betrayed by it. And also is, you know, it's the fact that, you know, both Daredevil and Captain America are attempting to keep Nuke from being killed.
Yeah. They're both men of honor, which.
Right.
Yeah.
And they both recognize that the character of Nuke is not of his own creation. It is created by something much worse. And so it's an interesting, those last two issues, it's an interesting way in terms of how they were trying to wrap up the series, because you get all of these sort of loose story arcs or loose plot lines wrapped up sort of in fast measure.
They
like the last two pages.
You know, they did go for spectacle
not much nuance.
Yes, not much nuance, exactly.
But Frank Miller has never really been about nuance.
Oh, no.
I mean, there are things about the story that, besides the fact that it reintroduces Karen Page, and even I agree that how they brought her in, you know, having to make her like a porn actress off screen, as it were, you know, when we meet her again after... It had been a long time since she had been in the comics, and, you know, a heroin addict shooting porn films for heroin and selling out Matt's name just for a fix, and then being so dependent on...
Yeah, who was that character's name?
Rollo. Or Paulo. But, you know, every scene with her was, of course, then after that, her, like, repeating Matt's name over and over and over. Got to get to Matt. Got to get to Matt. Matt's going to save me. Boy, howdy, that wouldn't fly in contemporary writing, that sort of overly dependent sort of weakness for a female character. I don't think would fly in this day and age, at least not amongst reasonable readers.
And that feeds into the things that bother me about this story.
You know, it does also set up bringing her back into the Daredevil universe, for good or for ill.
Yeah. Now, does that carry on? I mean, do people, that's not really referenced anymore, her porn heroin addict background.
Well, she's, are we doing spoilers here?
Sure.
Because, you know, she's gone again. She's dead in the Marvel universe.
but she was around.
I mean, dead never means dead. Actually, it is referenced because she goes on and she works in advocacy groups, helping to save women from the porn industry.
Huh.
Yeah. So it's the Innocenti really addressed a lot of that stuff when she was Karen Page.
Hmm.
So yes, okay. it was a lasting part of her character.
Okay.
Have you read the Daredevils that followed this arc and into the 90s?
Scattered. I mean, the arc that's right after the Last Rites, is it? It's right after this one. It's sort of the pseudo sequel to this.
Right.
Yeah, I have read that. But no, I really didn't pick up on Daredevil until into the 2000s. But, you know,
well, I would definitely recommend reading Anna Senti's run, particularly because it featured a young John Romita Jr.
Oh, okay.
On art. And it was Anna Senti who introduced Typhoid Mary,
who
created that character. Okay. So,
now, I didn't start picking up Daredevil again until like Brubaker and Bendis and Mark Wade, that sort of thing. Bendis, there's an example of writing violence without being cruel. There you go.
Or just writing a whole lot of dialogue.
Yeah.
But this isn't about Bendis. The other thing, of course, I think that makes this particular story arc important, of course, is the introduction of Maggie.
Yes, I agree.
And that has had, again, like with Karen Page and with some other things in this, it has had long-ranging effect on the Daredevil comic. So...
Yeah. Ian Begora. Aye, she's from Ireland. Get me some Lucky Charms.
well, you're talking Glory, right?
Glory. I'm sorry, not Maggie.
The Irish dialect from Glory is a little... Although there's that running gag of Foggy always telling her about things that she already knows about.
Well, yeah, it's the most common things.
Right. Here in the States, we have hamburgers or something, and, you know, and they say the same thing, and it happens like once every issue. It was an intentional, humorous bit, I think. So, see, Frank Miller has a sense of humor, but that ongoing, like, what is her response? She has the same response to him every time.
Yeah, we have that in Ireland as well.
Yeah, it's, but, Maggie, the nun.
The nun, yes.
Yes.
I'm sorry. I got us off on Glory.
Begora!
Ian Begora! Top of the morning to you, Foggy. Very cringeworthy.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. But yes, Maggie was, again, not very subtle with the whole cradling Matt in her arms.
Yeah, but that page, that image, the one that you're talking about,
yeah,
the splash page with her holding... Yeah, I mean, but they're talk about an iconic image that has been used over and over and over again. And whether it's subtle or not, you know, it is, even a Frank Miller can introduce, you know, it's like I said in the intro, he introduces grace into a situation where there is no grace. And whether or not she was his mother, I mean, we know the truth now going forward, but did not say specifically during this particular arc, but we know now.
I might be misremembering, but didn't they kind of basically come out and say?
They confirmed it when he basically, when he asked her, are you my mother? And she said no. And then he in his thought, but please bring back Thought Balloons comics. I miss Thought Balloons. Anyway, in his thought balloon, he of course was in his mind. He says, you know, I can read. She's lying.
Right. That's right. So, that's right. He has the, he hears her heartbeat and he knows that she's lying. That's what it was. That's what I'm remembering. Yeah.
It resolves in many ways the one thing, one of the major things that had been missing in Matt Murdock's life and one of the major holes in his heart, soul, stomach, spleen, wherever one has holes that need to be filled in their personal.
I've got a hole in my spleen.
That needs to be filled by a missing mother.
I don't know why. Let me spleen. Yeah. I'm cutting that out. That was terrible, Jen.
yeah, you might want to cut that out.
Yeah, I'm going to cut that out. Well, to be fair, he doesn't have daddy issues, which most comic book characters have.
Right.
This is a mommy issue. So.
Well, but he has daddy and mommy issues.
That's true.
I mean, because he doesn't have either.
Yeah, well, all your best superheroes, dead parents. So, is there anything else you want to discuss about the comic itself? Any particular?
Oh, I have a whole notebook of things, but I think we got a little derailed early on, and I threw most of those out the window.
Oh, sorry. Was it I who did I derail you?
It's all your fault, Paul, and I'm never talking to you again, at least for another week or two.
Oh,
I'm making sad faces.
Oh, well, I mean,
well,
in the end, I recommend reading this story arc in the sense that it's a work that has been incredibly influential, not only to Daredevil, but many other stories in comic books in general. And in that vein, it deserves to be read. And of course the artwork is stunning to look at. So yes, everyone should read this. It's just not something that I actually enjoy.
So Paul is recommending that everybody hate read it. No,
sure. If you want to do that.
Hey, we all hate watch, right? So it's time to hate read. And whereas
that's what Sue Storm says.
Oh,
hello.
Geez. Poor Reed Richards. He takes a lot of a brunt of a lot of our jokes as well, doesn't he?
It does. That's all right.
So overall, I would say I certainly see Paul's point, and I do agree in that Frank Miller is not the kindest to the characters he writes. Then it's hard for anybody to really disagree with that. Personally, I'm not sure it was necessary that Frank Miller like his characters as much as I, a fan of the comic, like the characters. And I think that he used them, and make no mistake, he used them in an appropriate way for the story that he was trying to tell. And I think for him, the story, yes, I agree with Paul also that the story was probably more important than the characters in Frank Miller's mind. But I also think the story itself was so well written, maybe not in terms of the characterization as Paul would have liked, but in terms of plotting and sequencing and dialogue and in the artwork itself, that I still think it's an important story arc. I think it's one of the most important story arcs in the Daredevil canon. And I recommend it to like Reed as opposed to hate Reed.
Yeah, no, I do agree that on a technical level, it's very well written and very well drawn. And it's structured, plotted, paced exactly the way you want a comic book to be. So again, opinions are subjective. So should we wrap up?
I think we should wrap up.
Okay. Yeah.
We need to have more. I think this was a fun discussion because we generally agree with each other. You know, I mean, look at the Terminal City podcast.
Yeah, that was just gushing for
which was just a love fest.
Yeah.
And I think it's good when we can find story arcs or comics where we disagree, and in some cases, not just disagree, but vehemently disagree. It makes for good discussion or makes for sharing.
I was a little worried about this one. When you brought it up on last episode, the end of last episode of what you were going to recommend, I kind of moaned a little bit like, oh, that one. I was a little worried that you were going to not like my take on this.
Well, I don't. Like I said, I'm not talking again for at least another week or two.
Fair enough.
So, Paul. Do you have a recommendation for the next podcast?
I sure do. Next time we will be discussing Gotham by Gaslight. This is an Elseworld story by Brian Augustin and Mike Mignola. The premise takes Batman and puts him into the 1880s on the trail of Jack the Ripper on the streets of Gotham. So, should be pretty interesting.
That sounds like fun. I haven't read that in many, many, many years, so I'm looking forward to digging back into that.
Yeah, I was thinking about this one, for some reason I was thinking it was late 90s, but it's 1989.
Yeah.
That was a while back. Holy cow. This one is a lot of fun, and maybe we'll agree on it.
Maybe we will.
All right. So thanks, everyone, for listening. And as always, please leave a comment or a rating on iTunes. That does help us get found. And any and all feedback is welcome. So if you disagree with me, let me know.
Or me.
I think it's going to be me this time. So until next time, everybody, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at the Daddy Elk Productions handle @DaddyElk and use the hashtag Collected Edition. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained? Are you not entertained?
Next time we will be discussing Gotham by Gaslight. This is an Elseworld story by Brian Augustin and Mike Mignola, out of Hellboy fame. I'm sorry to say that again because I've mispronounced his name. This is an Elseworld story by Brian.
I believe in you.
This is an Elseworld. Together. Mignola. This is an Elseworld story by Brian Augustin and Mike Mig. Oh, man.